Accession number 17183, Roman Halter, reel 7, followed after a pause by reel 8. Left channel is informant's mic only, right channel informant and interviewer.
Roman Halter, reel 7.
I must come back to the part where people were peeled into the hair shaving, disinfectant shower area. When we were there, suddenly, before it all happened, we were halted. Because the word went round, Auschwitz-Birkenau, passed on by Mengele, that the group from Lodz came, from metal factory, and they are going to be passed on as metal worker further on. And Auschwitz had Jewish prisoners who were sent very early on, 1943, 1942, end of 42. But what happened in Lodz ghetto was that there was a certain element, a certain underground element of Jews who were like Kray brothers, so to say. And Rumkowski managed to get rid of them because they created a great havoc of robbing communal kitchens, the kitchens, soup kitchens, and becoming a load to themselves. They consisted of pre-war porters and very tough individuals. And when they were sent to Auschwitz-Birkenau, Mengele recognized that these were criminal elements, so that he kept them. And so they were called to select whether everybody was from the metal factory or not. And they recognized some people who were in Jewish police, who were friends of Himovich. And so they were given sticks under SS supervision, and they used to knock some of these people down, put the stick on their throat and stand on it in order to suffocate them, to get their revenge for being sent to Auschwitz. Because these were the people who arrested them, because they were dreadful characters. And here they were lords of Birkenau. So some of these people from Lodz ghetto, from the hierarchy of the leadership, were finished off by these criminal elements, encouraged by Mengele and his officers there. When we were taken to that gypsy blocks, gypsy area, gypsy camp, and the following day, the women were in one and men another, these criminal elements said to Mengele, there are quite a lot of them that we haven't finished off, that don't belong to the metal factory. So Mengele came along to the block and asked that a rope in the middle should be put on longitudinally. We were on one side of the rope, and he said, he came with his officers, and he said, I'm going to ask you to do something, and you have to do it exactly what I tell you. And the head of the block had to shout what Mengele said, because he didn't want to strain himself. He spoke softly, and he shouted. So each time he repeated again like an echo. And the order was that we have to come up to the rope, stretch out our arms, and then, on a certain order, turn them over with palm up. So nobody knew what it meant. So everybody thought that the strongest and the best ones are going to be selected for certain purposes. So all the stronger ones came to the forefront, all along this block. The block in Auschwitz had what was called a chimney, a sort of elevated plinth running longitudinally. But it was not for burning, for heating the part. It was really a form of punishment. This brick had to be polished by some people who did the slightest sort of wrong, assuming they couldn't hold by going to the toilet and they peed on the floor or something like that. They were beaten and they were punished to make the block shine, this elevated plinth. So we all had to stand by this plinth, and on a certain order, hands were stretched out in front and then turned over. And Mengele and his officers came by and said, "You are a metal worker, such soft hands, palms. What did you really do in ghetto?" And these people were dying a thousand deaths when that was said. He said, "You are lying." And Mengele could even say a few words in Yiddish. And there was one man with a bucket with indelible ink, and he would write down the number and put here a sort of sign on the hands. And he said, "You will be dealt with soon." So we who were behind quickly spat on our hands and rubbed it on the floor in order to get any dirt into our hands, put it there. And we sighed a sigh of relief when this indelible ink wasn't put there. And then eventually when he's gone through the whole lot, he said, "If anybody dares to erase this indelible ink, first we'll cut your hands off and then we'll deal with you later." And they left. This rope was taken down and they left. And these people who had something written on it died a thousand deaths, because they were quite certain that they are going to be taken and sent to the cremation and murdered. But nothing happened. It was simply a sort of sadistic thing, which was Mengele's way of dealing with some people. And later on, we found out that he did various other sort of tricks of torturing people, of making them go out of their mind. Some of these people to whom it was, to whom it happened, they came in the morning and threw themselves on the electric wire because they couldn't stand it. They felt it's much better to finish off by getting electrified. So when we one day were taken from Auschwitz, and that was, we were there about 2 weeks or so, Auschwitz-Birkenau, and led, we didn't know where we were going to be taken to, gas chambers or taken on transport.
Could you tell me something about Mengele? What did he look like?
Well, he looked rather handsome. I mean, he had, as far as I remember, he had dark hair. And he had extraordinary, to me, he had a sensitive face. You know, he could be a don in a university, and one wouldn't think twice about it. Some of the killers, one didn't dare to look in their eyes, but he looked very sort of calm and benevolent. If facially, one wouldn't, if one came across him at Swiss Center restaurant, one would think that there is a murderer here of such proportions, that his soul is so black. It's quite extraordinary that the whole calm appearance was contrary to the murdering that he was performing. As this was the easiest thing that he could perform in life. I think the prototype of killers that we imagine was Mengele. Yeah. I just find it extraordinary how to say that. The proportion of the face were right. There was no sort of extraordinary deformity in his face. We also found that it was not right to look SS in the face, because they understood that that was a form of aggression. So one pleaded humility by looking down and never analyzing people. Also, it was accepted that when SS or a capo hit you, you fell down, that he felt proud that he achieved a knockdown by the first blow, whether it was terrible or not. You had then hoped that the kick which would follow would not be into kidneys or somewhere, would completely cripple you. so you covered your head up with your hands when you fell. There were certain sort of ways of how to go about this, which lasted right up to the point of survival. Also, if you, assuming, found a crust of bread, and if you were interrogated that you found the crust of bread, you said no, assuming it was in your stomach, no. Rather, you never knew what was wrong, what you did wrong, but if in doubt, always deny it.
You were 17 at the time.
Yes.
When all this was happening.
Yes.
Yes. And you know, your world had been turned completely upside down from what you're saying.
Completely, because also there was no precedent. You could not learn. You could not imagine that evil can be gradually so down and down, greater and greater. Whatever happened to us, you thought that was the worst, but in fact it wasn't. It was so unbelievably wrong, and yet it seemed never right to us. And also what was amazing is that the people who were selected to collaborate and carry out these terrible deeds were so superbly selected by them that they had no doubt about the murder of others. Right from people who were head of blocks, to capos, to other ones. They really accepted this sort of thing. There were very terrible, sick jokes that were uttered by some of these capos. For instance, when we were taken to the washroom, some of them said, "Oh, gold teeth are coming." I could not understand at that time, you know, that was explained to me. And there were extraordinary sort of scenes that took place. When we were taken to the station, we were counted, and it was found that some were killed straight away when we came, and there were not 500, some were missing. So these numbers had to be replenished, and quickly the numbers were made up. And instead of being taken to the guest chambers, we're taken, loaded up again onto trains, crowded in, and amongst us, a man who was not part of the metal workers, but was assigned to the group, and a friend of Himovich, was Dr. Kleszczelski, who said the cattle truck would be very crowded, so what you have to do is to sit down and open your legs, and the man sits between your legs, and the next man sits between the legs, and that way we'll be able to crowd in so many people in a comfortable way, because you will not be able to stand all the way, and we'll be orderly that way. And so we sat in this sort of one pleated long chain, one next to another, and he was all right. Because part of the way of getting one man hating another man is because you were overcrowded, you were not comfortable, you were very uncomfortable. So this helped us in the survival from Auschwitz to Stutthof. I like to go back to a scene in Lodz Ghetto. By 44, we're becoming quite important as a factory, the metal factory, on Wagiewnicka 63. And many people felt then that to work in the metal factory gives them a great chance of survival, because from ordinary work, we started producing more sensitive work, precision work, metal work. And then in early summer of 44, late spring, we're told that a very high-level inspection, German inspection, is going to come to Lodz Ghetto, to metal factory, just to us. And everything had to be kept clean and in working order. And we had some from the people who came from Germany and other countries and who were fleeced and then passed on, a couple who arrived from Germany, he was a qualified engineer, university trained, and he was seconded to the metal factory. And Himovich felt that he was very able and very creative, so he sheltered him. And although this man received a Bayrat ration from the well-being of Frankfurt, this meant very little in Lodz Ghetto, and he became very thin too. But I remember instances where we all queued to collect our soup, and we were all very hungry, so we used to go there with our aluminium containers, which we made ourselves in the metal factory, and put the lid on and come back and sit down and wolf the soup down. But he and his wife, who also worked in the metal factory, used to lay out the table with napkins. First have the liquid and then put the potatoes on breadboards, sprinkle salt and pepper, and cut the potatoes and make conversation and eat it. And I was very fascinated by this because I thought, this is ludicrous. Why do it go through this whole ceremony? So I asked them once, I said, why do you do this? So they said, well, if you lose your self-dignity, you are lost. You really become what they want you to become. Untermenschen. And I found it very strange to accept this. She had her hair made into a bun at the back, always very neatly combed. It was very hard to keep clean because there was no hot water to wash your clothing. And people did everything in order to look dignified and cleaned, and she especially so. Now, the inspection, when it came to our place, first the SS came to see that it's all safe, and then the entourage arrived, and the one who was leading them with the other SS was Himovich, and he spoke perfect German, Joseph Himovich, and he lined up all the section leaders. And this gentleman from Germany, he really invented a machine for making tips of bullets, which was in German called Kerngeschoss, where perhaps the machine was invented also somewhere else, but he knew about metals, and he said that if this is mixed with lead and zinc, it becomes soft enough, but yet good enough as a bullet, that the wire can be pressed into a die and the tip can be molded into that shape without machining. So the wires were on a sort of spool, which were pressed into a die and cut off and spat out. There was a little plunger at the back, very tiny one, without damaging it, and could make so many tips of bullets, thousands, in so many hours. And so Albert Speer arrived, together with, followed by some people from his department, followed by equivalent to a colonel and captain of SS and some other SS men. And he went from man to man without shaking hands, just along this line of section leaders. And then it was pointed out to him that this is the man who invented this machine for Kerngeschoss. And this man stood there with the highest decoration from First World War on his breast, which he won for Germany. To attention, looking thin, emaciated, and Speer talked to him. And of course, he talked beautiful German, coming from Germany. His most probably family lived in Germany for hundreds of years. He felt himself German. That was his place. What is he doing here simply by being a Jew? This is nothing to him. And so they spoke almost as equals, and Speer was very fascinated by him and asked him about this and this, various other things. We, the ordinary workers, were standing behind, and I thought, I must write up in my diary all this, and I must listen in to what is being said. But my German was not very good for it, not good enough really to understand or hear, and I was too far away. spear passed, then he wanted to know about, as he stood still by him, Himovich said the machine is somewhere else, but then spear turned around, so a huge machine there, enormous one, and quite a lot of black market went on, because between Bibov and Charnula and various other factories outside Lodz Ghetto, what happened was is that they made various deals from which they benefited, and they brought this enormous machine to the metal factory, which was a machine capable of pressing out almost equivalent to a road dividers, if you can see this metal plates which go along the road, so the crashes do not occur on the other side. It was quite useless there, and it was covered up on one side and then exposed, and so that the inspection could see this huge machine. And Speer, who had intellectual curiosity and curiosity of anything, said, "What's this here?" So Himovich didn't know what to say about this. So he called somebody else. And someone who was also in high position, called Steyer, with whom later on I escaped, stepped forward and said, "Sir, if I may tell you, I'm actually in charge of this machine and I can tell you all the facts. It weighs so many tons. It is too heavy now, and it's spring, can still have very frost, so we can't really cement it in because the bolts may come loose, the frost may affect us, but eventually we want to make protective gear for tanks to ensure that when the tanks are fired on, the shell would bounce off this, and we want to develop it so that not only they are in concentrated area but in one long area. Is there anything else, sir?" So Speer said, "No, that's all fine." So the man, Charnula, who was a sort of a German, who was part of the Gestapo, was very pleased with this explanation. One could see the sort of satisfaction on the face. And he passed on. And then the SS colonel, when he saw this man standing with the decoration, said to him, "Where did you get this?" Something like, "Where did you buy this order?" So he said, "I fought at Somme and this," you know, enumerated. So he said to his captain or lieutenant, whoever was behind him, that says, "Take it off him." So the captain got hold of this decoration, pulled it, and of course, this man fell down. So he put his foot on his chest and pulled it. Speer stood quite impassive, as if he was watching sort of geese flying over his head. He said absolutely nothing. His face did not show sorrow, did not show surprise, did not show empathy, nothing. He just sort of stood, because suddenly this became center of attraction. This sort of going through this parade meant nothing. And when this man ripped this decoration, this cross, off him, he ripped it with the cloth. And then Himovich said, "May we have permission to pick him up, because he's going to explain the machine for Kerngeschoss, for the bullets." So they picked up this man, who was all shivering, and he had to go along, and this tip of bullet machine was opened and started and demonstrated. But I was no longer there. We had to remain on this parade and stand to attention whilst he was taken there in this sort of quivering state. And the next day he died, and 2 days later his wife died. It somehow, with taking off this decoration, his heart was ripped out. And
that would have been after Speer had been talking to him.
Yes.
In such an interested, informal
way. Yes, yes. And the SS took absolutely no notice, and he did not stop the assessment. Perhaps he could have said, "No, please, leave him alone. We need him. He's an indispensable man." Nothing. This colonel and his subordinate felt that we are his property, and Speer, whether he recognized that, and he didn't want to get implicated in it at all. What I have found since, and that fascinated me, that in 44 Speer became ill, very ill, and his first disillusionment with Hitler came about then. That when he recovered and went to see Hitler, he saw him in a completely different light. He didn't see these deep blue penetrating eyes that he trusted, but a bulbous nose. And he said nothing in his Spandau secret diaries, neither does Gita Sereny, about his visit to Lodz Ghetto. But it was on his instruction, I'm sure, that he instructed his department to give us that piece of paper which saved us in Auschwitz-Birkenau from going to gas chambers and sent us on. Now, when we arrived in Stutthof, we thought that we'd be there a very short time. And Stutthof was dreadful as a concentration camp, because the area for sleeping on was much more confined than in Auschwitz. We had less space there. And the place was absolutely full of bugs, fleas, and lice. They were just eating us up. At night when you lay and you had the blanket, they just dropped down on you. And during the day, when we could sort of go behind the block, we used to take our jacket off, the striped uniform, and put it on a stone, and with the other stone, kill the seams in the lice. The lice in the seams, sorry. And also, it was close to the Baltic, and that was came to sort of November time, early November, and end of October, beginning of November, and the roll call was at 7 o'clock, but they used to chase out of blocks at 5:45 or 6 o'clock, sometimes then. And there were many sadists in the block. So what happened was that when it was time to get up, they used to come in with sticks and say, "Raus, raus, raus," and beat everybody. And when they hit you over the head, you could bruise you, and you had very little chance of surviving. Mm-hmm. And the block Eltester, the leader of the block, had these assistants who were trained sadists. And the door would be open, lights would be switched on, and everybody had to be out very quickly into the washroom, into ablution, and outside. It didn't matter whether it rained, whether it wind blew. We, in our sort of pajama-like striped outfit, had to stand there till 7 o'clock when the roll call was, when we were counted. And I became a very important person there in that block, because I have a way of telling myself what time to get up, and I can wake up. So I would sort of get up at 5:40 in the morning, I said, and in a minute now. And it was so. At first, people didn't believe me. And then, true enough, a few minutes later, when they opened the door, we were ready to get up. And so I was this alarm clock for the people around me. Suddenly, because of my ability of being able to wake up at a certain time, I became rather important and guarded by others. Now, the only way to survive there in this terrible wind when we stood for an hour was to form a human oven. That we came into a big sort of block, like a haystack, and rotated one way and then rotated the other way. And those outside came inside, those inside had to come outside after a few minutes. And anybody who was excluded from it suffered from cold and pneumonia and died. So really, the solidarity had to be between these people. And the capos realized that they couldn't kill us fast enough. So the SS said they should disperse us. But as soon as we were dispersed from one sort of human oven, we formed another one, because that was the only way to survive. Then one day, selection came, because the people from Spears' department realized that the only way